Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Between the American Bar Association's Energy, Environmental, Markets, and Finance Committee and the Washington College of Law, this is the Hot Air Show, your source for energy and climate opinions and editorial. Let's go around the table and introduce ourselves.
Toby Short, Director of Federal Affairs for Duke Energy Corporation.
Kevin Book from Clearview Energy Partners, Numbers and Energy Policy.
Jean Chemnick, I'm the Climate Change Reporter for Greenwire.
And Tyson Slocum, I direct the energy program with Public Citizen.
And your moderator today is Bill Snape. I'm usually a panelist, but Chris Barron could not be with us today, so I will attempt to wear two hats fairly and objectively. Ha, ha, ha. So let's start with the... I'm glad we're all getting a good truck. The Clean Power Plan. Our last Hot Air episode did cover the Clean Power Plan, but it had been out literally less than 24 hours. I think only Kevin had really read it at that point. And so what we'll start out with today's show, and again we'll start with Toby, just what do we think about this Clean Power Plan 2 months after the fact? Things that we didn't know 2 months ago or things that are more apparent now than ever? Toby.
I think it's still, 3,000 pages? With everything together, and still trying to look it over and try to figure it out. In some of the states where we operate, it's better. Some of the states is worse. Indiana was one of the states, along with North Dakota, that all of a sudden their emissions compliance was flipped from the proposed to the final rule. We're trying to get our heads around that, and everyone always talks about, well, what is your compliance plans? Well, we don't know yet because we're working with our states, and one of the states that we're working with is North Carolina, where we have a heavy presence, and depending on what they do, whether they're going to do a true SIP or, try to focus on one area in their SIP and then litigate, that's where we got to figure out. We've been, working with our state regulators and working with our state environmental compliance organizations to try to figure out how we're going to tackle this and what we're going to do. We still have some questions about the legality of it all and whether you can actually go outside the fence line, and those are things that in due time we will I guess figure out. So.
Well, let's get to that fence line question and even this issue of coal versus natural gas versus renewables. Let's put that to the side. Kevin, you've been crunching these numbers and looking at them. Are there any states that did particularly worse or better from proposed rule to final rule? I mean, are there any states that are looking at a much more difficult compliance schedule, in your opinion, than existed when the proposed rule came out?
There's a handful of states that there's two ways to look at it, Bill. The first is what the numbers required of the states in the proposal and in the final rule. The second thing is to look at what the states have done in terms of their own generation mix in the intervening years since the base year of 2012. There's a half dozen states that did meaningfully worse, Iowa being the most politically volatile of them. What you had was a more stringent reduction on a percentage basis than you would have had otherwise in emissions, whether it be mass or rate. But there are some states that are also ramping up their generation from coal-fired sources for one reason or another. And so when we ask what is better or worse, part of it's getting to what Toby was talking about, which is really the question of how states are going to choose to respond. The second is the question of their resource mix in terms of their intermediate term plans. Because some of them are already planning to retire from their resource mix, coal-fired generators, Washington State being the most obvious example, where in the proposal they were going to be able to succeed marvelously. But some of them have made significant retrofit decisions. The Clean Power Plan proposal didn't take into account a lot of plant shutdowns in their numbers. Those numbers are all baked into the final rule. And in the final rule, you're going to have some questions, some stresses, particularly in an environment where electricity demand, I know this doesn't sound like it's ever going to happen again, Toby, goes back up. And you actually,
I hope it does.
you start to see, particularly in a mass-based context, some challenges
right.
for the more coal-heavy states. But all in, you know, roughly three dozen did more or less as well or better. So it was really a small minority of states, which, curiously enough, was also six of the 15 or so states that were in the protesting, just say no camp before the rule.
Interesting. Indiana and North Dakota stick out.
Yes, also Indiana and North Dakota.
So, Tyson, any thoughts you have in general? But the one question I'm curious to have you at least try to touch upon is, what about the renewable part of the best emissions system reduction? What states, in your view, are poised to actually make their targets quite easily because of renewable opportunities? But I don't want to box you into just that question. Any other thoughts about
right,
that?
Right. Well, I think 2 months in, it just confirms that at the end of the day, this is a very modest rule, that states have lots of time and lots of flexibility to come up with a plan to comply with what the EPA has laid out. And this modest rule is not necessarily the way it's being characterized. You know, in Washington, D.C., policy debates, facts aren't always relevant. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing this become more of an electoral issue, which is unfortunate. If we stick to the facts and stick to what the EPA is asking states to do and the flexibility that states are being given, this essentially just locks in status quo of where the energy and utility sector was heading. So I think if we just stick to the rule, I think states will be just fine.
Gene, what do you think about what Tyson just said specifically? I mean, it's an open-ended, so talk whatever. But the idea that this is really a modest rule and that those that are complaining about it aren't maybe being as...
Sure. Well, I mean, it's a pretty significant rule. I mean, 32% in 15 years is quite a reduction to be compelling, I guess. I won't weigh in on whether it's modest or not, but it's true that then some states that had very light standards in the draft version, you know, ended up with quite stringent standards, and it has to do with the formula, how they're assessing, you know, responsibility based on your past emissions and whatnot. And they completely rewrote how they were, you know, assigning responsibility between the draft and the final version. And the outcome is that coal-heavy states, which happened to be Republican-led states, ended up with much more stringent standards than they did under last year's draft. So it becomes kind of a political issue, although it kind of already was, you know, because... you know, sort of the coastal, you know, very low carbon states that didn't have, that had fairly, you know, stringent standards under the draft are now, you know, in a better position. It also flips in certain cases, you know, EPA is really selling the idea of interstate cooperation as a means of compliance, and it flips in certain cases what states might have the advantage or be able to sell credits versus buy them.
Yeah.
In certain regions, especially in sort of in the West, you know, some states were better positioned to provide credits under the draft, and now they'll be possibly buying them. You know, it's interesting.
So I'm going to hold off on what is essentially a cap and trade discussion. I want to revisit that, but I'm going to go. I saw some body language from Toby and Kevin made the one Tyson was talking, and what I heard Tyson say was, "Hey, look, these goals essentially that EPA created is where the states were going anyway. These are not going to be that." I want you to respond to that, but I specifically want you to respond and think about the association of this rule with the ozone rule that was just finalized this past week, where I think you could argue. I mean, I still don't personally understand the state numbers, and Kevin, maybe by the end of this hour, I can understand what these numbers actually really mean. But I tend to agree with Tyson, and if you look at the ozone rule, where the administration picked 70 parts per billion, which was just enough to do some reduction, but was really on the wimpy side of the reduction, I think one could argue that whatever these state numbers mean, they're probably the equivalent of the 70 part per billion standard. It's the same level of political push. It's the same level of political modesty that Tyson's talking about. So maybe I'm comparing apples and oranges. I know that I am on some level. But how do you respond to that these ultimately, Tyson's point is, these state targets are really not that ambitious. They are pretty modest, and they actually project where EPA thought the states could actually get pretty easily. Is that fair, or do you reject that?
You're the numbers guy, so you can correct me if I'm wrong. But under the modeling, the base case was 17% reductions compared to 32% reductions, which I don't see that's business as usual. That's almost a doubling of the reductions. So I don't think it's as easy or as modest as people assume that it is. Because, yes, while we can deploy certain technologies, you can only do that in certain areas. North Carolina, great example of where we're doing a lot of solar. South Carolina, not so much. So I don't think it's as modest as people tend to believe. It might not be as bad as what some people want to yell and scream about, but I don't think it's as easy what some people would try to lead you to believe.
Well, I think your reference point is going to matter a lot. The REGI states, for example, have a binding target relative to CPP from REGI. So assuming they don't blow it off, which you can do in REGI, but that's a separate topic. So they're actually going to hit it by 2020, a level that's below where they would be required to get to by 2030 in the aggregate under CPP. So in that context, you'd say, oh, yeah, that's business as usual. In fact, that's business that's been done before. That's not true everywhere in the country. Again, it's not going to be the same thing when you see resource mixes changing towards more coal-heavy generation. Retrofitted plants in Indiana, using Illinois Basin coal, which is high heat but high sulfur. Suddenly, you know, you've solved one problem emissions-wise, but you're not going to be low carbon, not with coal.
So let's follow up on that point. I mean, I think that's a fair pushback. Putting aside the methane emissions from natural gas, just assuming they don't exist, which I think is what EPA essentially does in this rule, is natural gas and are renewables an option for the states that may have a tougher time, in your view, reaching? I mean, and why not? Toby's saying
well,
no.
Well, right? If you go to a mass base, don't you have a different cap?
My understanding of the cap, just so we're clear on that issue, for a view, you know, there's a rate base and a mass base. My understanding, and it's confusing in the rule. My understanding of what EPA is saying is they're going to have a translation table so you can use whatever you want whenever you want, and that they will be that there is no requirement to do rate-based, which I think is a problem in and of itself. So I think
But what they were worried about was the fact that I close down all my coal and I build new gas, therefore I'm not under 111D. I'm now under 111B, and therefore I don't have to comply with that. Well, guess what? In that case, emissions are going to go up because if need be, I close my gas plant, my inefficient gas plant, and build a new one.
Well, not so fast. That's not right. It's around page 1134 to 1138, somewhere in that neighborhood. But they actually have a stipulation saying that for your SIP to avoid getting FIPped, God, for listeners, I am so sorry, for your state implementation plan to pass muster with the EPA so it doesn't impose a federal implementation plan, you're going to have to come up with some rules of your own. And even though they cannot mandate that those new sources be included in the plan, they recommend that a compliant SIP will do that.
And be allowed to do that.
Yeah.
No, and the FIP, the draft FIP, which I actually
that means that they're
provides
not,
for that.
That won't be leakage then, because now you'll be modifying your base emissions rate by the gas that you're burning. You won't be able to get out of jail free like Toby's
right.
saying.
Well, I'm not saying that you would. I said that's why you would have to set up that situation.
What I'm trying to get at is I make the assertion, and I think Tyson's making it, that for the states, as Kevin and Toby have both, and well, you know, to the extent that some states are going to have a harder time meeting their 2030 target than others, and we acknowledge that there might be some states having a harder time, I'm asking, how difficult will it be for those states with maybe a slightly harder quote-unquote target to meet it by switching to natural gas and renewables? That's what Gina McCarthy's telling us, essentially, that the states can do it. And it seems to me from the rule that it is doable, but you're the technical guys. Why is that incorrect? Why are some states not going to find natural gas or renewables as an option to have them meet these quote-unquote modest state targets? What am I missing on that?
The gas build-out that you'd have to do in terms of new gas is pretty significant. You need to have infrastructure in place. You need to have laterals from pipes. It's not that you can't do it. It's that you're going to do it at cost. And in terms of renewables, you're not going to do it. There are state renewable portfolio standards that are taking you on trend to a pretty impressive target. 12% by 2020 on a national average basis, about 14% by 2030, if you extrapolate and fudge the numbers and assume the states stick with it. That is assuming the states stick with it. And yet, you're still going to be expected to hit somewhere close to 17% under the CPP. These are very, very hard to do, not just in terms of managing the intermittency, but everything from the siting to the expense itself. We have a very, I think I mentioned this in the last show, we still don't know whether solar has become organically competitive, and we're there. We're at the point where it's just going to fall into place, or whether when the ITC reverts back to a 10% credit, which it very well could do, we're just going to find out that solar panels grew where subsidies shined. So,
Gene or Tyson, before we leave this topic, any last comments on this mix of fuels and these state targets?
Well, I think, I mean, ultimately, it's not going to be this administration that's going to be, you know, giving the final review process for this, right? It's going to be the next administration, which makes me shudder at how unqualified the slate of candidates on both sides appears to be. But that said, I think that, again, the opportunities for renewables, the opportunities for natural gas, the opportunities for efficiency, even though it was removed as one of the formal tracks, efficiency still is going to be playing a very big role in this. States have a heck of a lot of tools at their disposal to meet these modest emission targets.
Including trading, now trading we can talk about, Gene. So talk to, you know, whatever perspective you own trading, what, you know, realizing we're all still learning what the rule says, but let me throw you a softball just to get you going and then take it in any direction
like
you want.
Softballs.
I mean, this rule obviously is different than the Waxman-Markey bill, but this is essentially cap and trade through regulation, is it not? Is this basically Waxman-Markey through the agency, or other ideas?
It isn't Waxman-Markey, but it's interesting. I cover all of these hearings, and it gets tiresome because there are a lot of the same arguments are played at a lot of these hearings. And yesterday it was all, this is cap and trade through the back door. You know, from it was an Energy and Commerce Subcommittee chaired by Whitfield, who's, you know, pushed legislation twice to get rid of this rule even before it was final. And, you know, that was sort of the constant refrain from the Republicans on the panel, was that it was cap and trade. And there was Janet McCabe from EPA saying, oh, no, it's not. You know, we don't require cap and trade. But then I noticed that there were five explicit references to trading in her prepared remarks, and there were two or three others that was what she was talking about. And it is, I mean, look, it's some form of trading, and cap and trade is a pretty formalized version of exchanging, you know, emissions allowances. And there are, you know, steps lower on that, you know, they can do, but some form of interstate cooperation is how they get around, you know, questions of cost and of reliability frequently. So I think that there are going to be, I think that they're really encouraging some form of cooperation pretty heavily.
Very diplomatic.
Yeah. It was. Yeah. So realize
that. Keep her job.
Exactly.
The rest of us are apparently the same caution.
So realizing we're not all lawyers at the table, and if we are lawyers, we're maybe doing different things. Let's go around the table and talk about what we know is going to be litigation against this rule. When will we see this rule in the Federal Register, by the way? I mean, this is an odd.
Half of the month.
Okay. You know. But, you know, we're having some pre-discussion before we formally started our show tonight about that. But, Toby, we'll start with you. I mean, there is going to be litigation. What can you tell us about what that litigation might look like? And do we have any predictions?
We don't comment on ongoing litigation.
There you go. Well, it hasn't been filed yet, so there's your opening.
No, I mean, and we were discussing, you know, perhaps, and it's no state secret, like North Carolina or other states, want to be the first one out the door to say, okay, this is my SIP. It's only within the side of the fence line. We're going to say, you know, 2-3% heat rate improvements at our coal plants or whatever. We're not going to meet the targets that EPA has stated. Now, please deny us. And once they get denied, then, you know, they have a right of action. They go to court. They want to, you know, they basically want to litigate outside the fence line. They want to litigate that because, you know, in my opinion, this is not about carbon. This is about setting the best system of emissions reduction. And it's about setting the precedent for not only regulating here, but regulating somewhere else. And once you have that set, then you can use whatever, you know, whatever statute you want to use to basically regulate whomever you want to regulate in whatever fashion you want to. No. And that's, they want to be, in North Carolina especially, and I'm sure other states, want to be in the position of saying, oh, well, we led the charge. Now, if you're EPA, you have, I guess, a year to up or down, whatever. And, you know, from what I understand, a SIP is an ongoing negotiation, usually, of no, it's not necessarily what we want. How about if you do it this way, that way, whatever. If you're EPA and you know this is what the state wants, are you really going to play into that? Or are you just going to sit on it and say, we'll get back to you. Don't call us, we'll call you.
So, Toby, I'm so glad you teed that up. And you know, I that's what I've heard as well. But I want to tease out a couple issues of what you said. One is that EPA does say in the final rule, I do know this, that states can do a purely inside the fence strategy. EPA says that over and over again. So the issue that will be raised with what the scenario you just raised with North Carolina as an example of that is that somehow that inside the fence proposal won't reach the numbers. And if that's the case, EPA could order a FIP. I see that under the reg. But it seems to me that EPA won't want to do that. And it seems to me that there'll be lots of opportunities for EPA to cajole or be nice or whisper sweet nothings to these states. For instance, let me just give an idea. These plans are not due till 2018. EPA then has another year. That's 2019. You know, so we're talking 3 years from now to have these sort of whatever discussions. And 2022 are just the first targets. They don't have to meet them, you know, until 2029. So my question is to either Toby or Kevin going down the line here around the table, even the hostile states, EPA is going to want to keep working with them. But
if you're hostile, you don't care. You don't want to work with the EPA. Your goal is to get rejected so that you can go to court.
And I think EPA is going to maybe say no. Kevin, what do you think about this?
Well, I think that's a novel strategy to become accommodating in an effort to deflect your opponent's desire to subvert your rule and becoming, in the process, so accommodating that you subvert your own rule. I see how lawyers stay so well employed. There's two things I think that are pretty much obvious. The first one is that outside of these few combative states, like North Carolina, a lot of states are looking at just-in-case SIPs, where they'd rather not get denied. And as they start making those decisions, and the utilities start making their resource planning decisions, and the PUCs start funding it and approving it, stuff's going to happen. So the first biting year may be 2022, the first time to pay up may not be till 2029. But by the time you get there, much like with MATS, which sits in limbo despite all of the retrofits and retirements that have happened because of it, I think you'll find that the fleet has changed. Second is on the Republicans themselves. This is a fantastic campaign issue. Always will be. It's a perfect wedge. It's exactly what they want. But does a Republican administration necessarily jump into the morass of trying to roll it back? Or do they live within it? With all that's going to be going on, they'll have a full administration plus another couple of years if they get a second term, if they get a first term, to figure it all out. I'm not sure that there's any sort of rescission coming either. So what we're really talking about is whether your strategy might not be the right one, Bill, where you effectively let momentum carry you. Sorry, North Carolina, we don't want to make
work. See, I think we're saying the same thing. But Tyson and or Gene, Kevin's laid out some interesting predictions here.
I think it's impossible to predict how courts are going to rule on this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple of interesting issues. We have to remember that a lot of the political attacks and some of the states that are attacking this are framing this as, you know, an out-of-control, you know, D.C. regulatory system, forgetting the fact that it was the John Roberts Supreme Court that started all of this in 2007. And so the question I think that needs to be asked of these critics of the rule is, well, then how would you comply with the Supreme Court mandate that we regulate greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act? We need to start hearing some concrete alternatives, and the just say no strategy just isn't a legitimate political strategy at this point. And on another issue where most of the attacks seem to be on going after the outside the fence options because they are straying a little bit from the underlying statute's authority. The thing about the outside the fence options is that they are there to accommodate and make it cheaper for utilities and states to meet the rule. So the EPA is doing wiggle room to help the states out, to cut the cost of compliance down, and yet that is the center of attack. And I don't find that to be legitimate.
Sure. You know, I have an interest. I thought that we thought that they were going to expedite litigation and try to do it under the Obama administration. And obviously this group of states is poised, and maybe there's even more than one lawsuit. Probably. Yeah, there are. with different tries at it. You know, all sort of already ready and you know, going to be filed the minute this thing is in the Federal Register. So, and this is an honest question, I find that I don't really know. I mean, if you've already tried whether or not you can, you know, stray outside of the fence line, if you've already tried whether you can regulate under 111D instead of 111, you know, 112 because you're doing the mercury rule, and if you've already done all of these things, then what is gained by trying to challenge EPA on a particular SIP, like you're saying that North Carolina would do? Because if it's already established that you can have a more expansive rule, wouldn't you already be know that you were set up to fail?
But where was that established?
Well, I mean, if you know, they would sue. You know, presumably, if the rule was knocked down.
Well, let me kind of answer that just, and then let Toby go around for me.
I'm just wondering.
It's a very interesting. We're on an interesting train here. Let me just give some context. When the utility air group case was decided by the Supreme Court, that was the tailoring rule case.
Right.
We forget, or we're not remembering now, that the majority opinion was written by Justice Scalia. And to his right were Alito and Thomas. To his left were Breyer, Ginsburg, Kagan, and Sotomayor. The Chief Justice and Scalia and Kennedy were occupying the middle. And what that case said was, in the context of permits, which I realize is different than the new source performance standards, that for the big entities, like the big power plants, already being regulated, you can add on GHG regulation. That's no problem. That's what Mass versus EPA says. Scalia says that. Scalia has no longer is bitching about Mass. He's buying into the system. And what I think that means for the conversation that Gene and that Kevin started us also on a couple minutes ago is that I think eventually the Supreme Court is going to look at what EPA did. In fact, I think EPA wrote the final rule looking at that utility air group case, and they're saying, okay, wait a minute. So they took out that energy efficiency from the proposed rule of the final rule. That's no longer a part of BSCR. Okay, that's outside the fence line. They tried to be inside the fence line. Okay. All these outside the fence line issues are all options. If a state doesn't want to do outside the fence, they just do their heat rate improvements or their mass improvements. So what I'm trying to say is, I think you can't predict Justice Scalia. I can't even believe that I'm even insinuating that he might be the Chief Justice might be the protector of this rule. But there is a precedent at the court that at least for the big entities, which is really what this rule is all about, they're not going to give EPA a hard time. They're going to defer. I think there is an argument to be made.
But didn't Scalia also talk about standing on a dock, waving, you know, that the Supreme Court wasn't going to stand on a dock and wave and,
yeah, there
and
was
let
that.
Them.
I mean, what I'm saying is it might go either way. I have no idea which direction. I'm not going to weigh in on which direction. But my point is, in terms of timing, I mean, you're already at the point where North Carolina is submitting a SIP. By the time North Carolina would be submitting a SIP, you'd already have it established which way the Supreme Court was going to go. Because all these states, you know, the West Virginia group and you know, North Dakota and everybody will have sued starting, you know, later this month, and aren't they going to try to wrap
it? But that's what I'm saying is I think that they're going to argue, I mean, injury in fact, because they already got rejected. And I'm not saying that North Carolina is the only one, and I don't think I'm saying any secrets, but I don't know if that going outside the fence line is going to be litigated.
Oh, it's definitely going to be litigated.
Well, what standing do they have? I mean, the question for them will be standing, but you'll have a state that actually got rejected by staying inside the fence line and the EPA saying, oh, that's not good enough.
It may be that I'm not a lawyer and so I'm not understanding.
Or maybe I'm just saying totally wrong.
Well, so it's going to be litigated. But we know that.
But what I wanted to go back with was, you know, Tyson made the comment of, you know, these are just ways to get to these numbers. Well, where did the numbers come from? The numbers came from the fact that, oh, well, the EPA assumed you could do all these things.
The numbers come.
So it's like, oh, well, you don't have to go outside the fence line to hit these numbers, but we assume to get these numbers that you're going outside the fence line.
That's a fair point.
So,
okay.
All right. But I think EPA's answer to that. But EP, EPA's answer to that is, and this is where Kevin's number crunching is important, it's always important, but particularly important here is, but qualitatively in the rule they say, we created the numbers for each state based upon only the power plant numbers. We recognize that for some states, they won't only want to do power plant because that's too hard or too expensive. As Tyson said, we're going to give you these outside defense line options as a way to comply if you want. And I think that's they're claiming, in other words, that those numbers, which I don't really understand still, but qualitatively they equate those numbers to the power plant numbers, their projection of power plant numbers, that the numbers are inside the fence numbers based on the NSPS, but they're allowing you to comply with inside those fence numbers with outside the fence options.
I honestly didn't know that. I thought they were down to the three building blocks from the four.
Building blocks that are a part of the formal inside the fence line. The outside the fence line options all exist.
Illustrative.
That's why there's like hundreds of pages.
That you used them.
That's why there's hundreds of pages of verifying either trades or efficiency. You have to go through. If you do, like the way Toby said to start this conversation, if a state, even if it's hostile, just sends in the heat improvement numbers, that's all they do, it's actually an easier SIP. EPA says that the complication in terms of compliance with your SIP only comes into play if you want to do the trading. There's more paperwork if you want to do the trading and outside the fence.
Yeah, but the way you do it is you either go to a rate-based system, which is per megawatt hour of CO2, and that's you. To get there, you do heat rate efficiencies, and then you do other things, and then you average them and things like that. I don't understand how they assume that you're going to get a better pounds per megawatt hour of CO2 from cliffsides or from the big boilers that we've already changed out in our other plants. I don't understand how they think that. Oh, sorry. I don't think how you're going to get those down unless you go to a mass base. And you say, okay, inside the fence line, we're going to go to a mass base in our state, and we're going to close down that.
It might envision some of that. Kevin, what do you think about some of these numbers?
Your heat rate improvement options realistically get you a 2 or 3% reduction, and I don't see how you get 20 or 30 without shutting down plants. So, yes, you can stay inside the fence line. You're just going to have to put the word closed on the outside of a lot of those fences.
Yeah, I agree with Tyson. Any last word or Jane before we leave this topic? I think that's probably right. Mm-hmm. I don't dismiss that, but for some states that's the case. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so this is going to be litigated. We will still be talking about this clean power plan in 1 year, 2 years about its. But let's talk about at least the near future, which is at the very least we know this administration is going to go to Paris, already is in the later stage of negotiations talking about this clean power plan. So here's the softball question, and we'll see where this goes. What does the Clean Power Plan mean for Paris? Does it mean anything? And I guess the follow-up question is, does Paris mean anything? Toby, you're to my left. How about that?
I'm going to let somebody else start off because this is an interesting thing for me.
The EPA rule is central to Paris. This settles this whole chicken and egg debate that's been happening between China and the United States for years, where we say, hey, China, you've got to come to the table with some proposals on climate change. And China says, yeah, okay, we'll do it as soon as you do, right? And the Clean Power Plan is that final rule that gives the Obama administration credibility in China and elsewhere to say, here's our plan, China, now what say you? And so that's why we've seen a willingness by the Chinese government to put forward some. Now, granted, I don't have a whole lot of faith in the numbers that are going to be coming out of China's compliance claims over the next several years. But the fact of the matter is, what we've got for the first time ever is all the major polluters coming to some sort of agreement in Paris. Is it going to be enough? Of course it's not. But it is the first step where the world recognizes that climate change requires a global solution. And it's baby steps. There's going to be plenty of problems with it, but I think that this is a huge victory in terms of making progress internationally.
You know, just a factual note before we open it up to other panelists, that now before the UNFCCC, the United Nations treaty body that oversees these Paris Accords, over 100 countries have submitted formal commitments, and the number grows almost by the day, and we're up to over, of those countries, covering 80% of greenhouse gas emissions throughout the globe. Now, for all the reasons Tyson said, we don't know, we haven't looked underneath the hood of all those commitments, we don't know, we can't verify them yet, but
They're not commitments.
But they're on the table, and they're called commitments at least as a matter of soft law. So
Kevin,
there you go. Let's talk about what you think, what do you think Paris holds, and what does it mean?
The top-downy world of central global federalism and Kyoto extracted commitments. There was a first commitment period. The idea was that you made a promise and you were expected to keep it. The bottom-uppy world, post-Durban and everywhere else, leading us to Paris, is where you make an intended contribution. Now, I intend to contribute every year to my church. I do. I swear. And I never quite keep up with what I said I was going to do. And I think that without an enforcement body, and I guess mine will smell like brimstone, but everyone else's has to be something hegemonic and strong enough to keep you online. I don't know that the Paris process by itself does, as you asked in your second question, mean anything. I agree utterly with Tyson that without this, the United States could not be the momentum driver that it is, and the process wouldn't be going anywhere at all. But where it goes raises plenty of questions. What does it mean to make an intended, nationally determined contribution that you cannot keep? Now, the people in our own State Department negotiating this, who are very skilled and gifted negotiators and public servants, say that there's a shame factor that will keep everybody on board, that countries will know better than to break their word on the world stage. I submit Vladimir V. Putin, for whom shame has never been much of a factor. I am not a big believer in shame. I think border tariffs might be the logical consequence of this, but we're a long way from this actually doing anything at all.
Gene, that was power-packed. Anyone want to? I have some thoughts, but
or even references to hell. I mean, I don't know how to follow that. I think that, you know, it'd be incredibly disappointing to a large segment of people if nothing comes of Paris. I think something will come of Paris. I mean, the way they've sort of built it is that it is a first step, and that there's going to be some kind of formalized, you know, regular intervals. You have to increase what you're bringing to the table, you know, over time, with the sense that it'll ramp up, and as people in some future period where maybe climate change is more of a focus than it is some places, people will bring more to the table, maybe every 5 years or so. I don't know. This, as far as Obama is concerned, he's really put a lot towards this, and maybe that's part of, you know, his justification for doing his domestic policy, is that he needs to show that the rest of the world is also stepping up, and so he's made this a major part of his bilateral talks with a range of countries. Right.
And Rolling Stone magazine tells me he's committed, so exactly. I think that's important. Let me ask it in a different way. I mean, those are all very good answers, and I accept all of them. Yes, Toby.
You can go ahead, but I'm assuming that the Republican Congress will do everything they can between the time that it's published in the Federal Register in Paris to undermine the credibility of any negotiation between the United States and the rest of the world.
They've already done it. They've already sent letters.
But that's part of it. One part would be the two CRAs that will be on deck. Legislation, I know that's already passed the House. They'll pass it in the Senate. I wouldn't be surprised, and I don't have any inside knowledge on all this, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody introduced the Clean Power Plan in Congress, in the Senate, just for it to go down.
Well, those are some interesting thoughts. Here's why it doesn't.
Because that would give my vulnerable Republicans something to vote for.
But here's why maybe
full well that it wouldn't pass.
But here's why it maybe doesn't matter. Here's why it maybe doesn't matter. So I had an old colleague who's actually negotiated international environmental accords, and this is a story that was told to me third hand, but I love the saying. Saying that in international agreements, there are two types of results. There is success, and there is real success. And it seems to me that going into Paris, we already have success. We already have 80% making the contributions, despite all of the things that Kevin said, which I actually don't disagree with. they're going to claim success. And there's going to be some form of success. We're already in a better space than we were heading into Copenhagen, for instance. So on some level, there's already success. So then the real question is real success. And obviously, we can't answer that maybe even in December, maybe not even a year from December. But I certainly think a model is the Iranian nuclear agreement, where the president didn't need the Congress. In fact, ultimately didn't care. He did, but didn't care. And because the Clean Air Act gives the president authority to negotiate this agreement, you know, the Republican actions, until they can actually get something passed, it's just hot air. No pun intended. So I think the real issue is, how do we get to real success with Paris? Or is it even feasible? Kevin, you look contemplative.
Well, I mean, look, if you could have picked, I understand your point, and I agree with what you're saying in terms of process. I just think that if you were going to find a simulacrum, a parallel, I wouldn't use the Iran nuclear deal.
What would you use?
Well, the way you do it is the way you do the Iran nuclear deal, yes, but you probably don't want to use the example of the single most destabilizing event in Middle East politics for the next 10 years. Separate topic. First of all, the Obama climate agenda is bigger than Paris, and it is bigger than CPP. You know, and those are two of maybe four parts of it. Part three is the NEPA reform, which if there's institutional continuity with a Democrat in the White House, very much enforces the life cycle evaluation of infrastructure projects, is going to change things where the rubber meets the road. The fourth one is kind of a subtle little thing I call vocabulary. Tyson's already used the word pollution. He didn't talk about emitters. He talked about polluters. It is now pollution that people are trying to stop because it is a crisis that they're facing. Lawmakers are not very good when there's not a crisis. A perfect example is that our energy policy is completely screwed up, and no one's in any hurry to fix it because they have a surplus, not a crisis. When they have a shortage, they come up with things like ethanol mandates in a hurry. This is a situation where if you call it a crisis and you use the word pollution for long enough, even if everything else in the Obama legacy is impaired, whether it's the Paris process, the CPP, or even the NEPA reforms, it's possible that the societal momentum continues anyway.
So you're saying that that this is really about language, and I do think it's about science, and the science has been overwhelming and compelling for a long time, and I think Obama is staking his legacy, part of his legacy, on getting the world into the next steps beyond Kyoto. That includes all the major polluters or emitters, whatever word we want to use, and that sets into motion something that extends beyond his presidency. And so, again, it's not perfect, but it's impossible to put something together that's going to be perfect on this kind of scale. But what it does is that it sets in motion opportunities for the world to collaborate in useful ways, to coordinate efforts to address what the science has been screaming at us for an awful long time, which is we need to act or else our grandchildren are not going to have a very nice planet to live on.
And is it possible, Kevin, that the words, because you're making, I agree with Tyson, but you're making a powerful point as well, that the words actually are a part of this concept in international law called soft law, and that even in domestic law, we have things that look like soft law. And so these words, which are just words, and sometimes words that may not even be fully realistic, you're certainly making that point with Toby, that some of this may not, at least today, doesn't appear realistic, but that it's going to do the very things that Tyson said because the president has changed the vector arrow and it's now pointing in a direction that was different than even a couple of years ago.
Are you going to vote against pollution? Are you going to turn your back on a crisis? No, I'm serious. Like, at some level, societal sentiment is changing anyway, right? The Pope's encyclical wasn't a leading indicator of anything. It was a barometer of where people were going. This might be the last Republican primary where everybody says no to climate change, right? There might be another one in the 2020 election process, which is different, and it'd probably be because if they want anyone to come out, they're going to need to reach age groups
right.
where people believe
right.
in climate change.
Well, let's get that. There is a crisis, and I think people are beginning to, you know, the South Carolina floods. I think more and more people are realizing have something to do, perhaps, with this thing called climate change. We saw the poll numbers out in the last 10 days that even among conservative Republicans, well above 50% believe in climate change. So I think people are grasping that, and I guess what I'm trying to say with the Clean Power Plan and Paris Paris that these words, while just words, maybe will change the template of the discussion. And it will be interesting to see, you know, maybe this will be the last time Republicans are anti-climate going into an election. This may be the end of that.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all.
But remember, the Republican opposition to these efforts on climate change during the Obama administration, it's an anomaly. Right, James Inhofe was a co-sponsor of the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments under Republican George Herbert Walker Bush. Republicans had a long-standing history of being leaders on environmental issues. When I first started working on this stuff, it was John McCain's staffers that played a leading role in the Senate in coordinating efforts on climate change. So what we're looking at, we're making a lot of arguments. It's really just kind of a short-term situation where Republicans have dug in their heels against the scientific consensus, and I think that this climate deal, while absolutely imperfect, is actually going to help lead the Republicans eventually into a more sensible and rational position on addressing climate change.
And as far as you referenced the campaign to tell the world that the Congress is not behind Obama
right.
in Paris, which I think that that's well underway,
right.
and that goes as far as it goes. I mean, I guess actually that McConnell's staff have been calling, you know, embassies, and they did write. Corker's staff wrote a letter, which was actually fairly neutral, but to John Kerry.
Well, I noticed that Cotton was not the lead this
yes,
time.
Yes, that's true. There is that. And
but if you remember correctly, Corker called the whole cap and trade Rube Goldberg. Is that what it was?
You know, I mean, and they will have a bunch of votes this fall, and some of them might be aimed directly at but the international community also isn't unaware of our political situation,
right.
and so this isn't new information to them. And I think there is a sense that the tide is turning a little bit in public opinion in this country, and there have been some polls that have shown that. So they might be aware of those things too, and that maybe this is sort of a moment in time. I don't know.
I would think that what they would like to articulate is the fact that in the next after this election, if you have a Republican administration, those commitments, contributions, however you want to characterize them. That'll be on y'all, but the United States is not going to fulfill theirs.
That's their message. That's what they're saying, yeah.
Right. So.
That would be what they're saying, yeah.
And it isn't entirely
right.
clear.
That's
wrong. Whereas, now here's where the Iran deal parallel breaks down. The Iran deal is enshrined in the UN compact and will be very hard for the next Republican president to walk away from without creating significant cascading effects within the UN. On the other hand, this isn't going to be enshrined in anything like that. It's not going to be a UN Security Council compact. It's going to be an agreement signed that we're going to take home and try to live by.
But it's only agreement.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, Kevin. That's an interesting point, and we'll just have to wait and see. That's probably what we'll play out over the course of the next couple months. And so let's give you your last question. And it gives you a last word as well. So we will probably not convene again until the new year. We will probably not convene as Hot Air until after Paris. What do you think we'll be saying in January of the new year? Where will be the state of climate politics and what we've discussed today? We'll start with Kevin. Where will what will be the hot discussion in January in your view?
I think we'll still be talking about whether or not the rich countries paid enough to the poor countries as part of the deal that came out of Paris. The seamy underside of this negotiation is going to be the money that the West and the industrialized nations are willing to put up. And right now that's still a fight in our Congress, and right now it's still not a number big enough to truly meet the mitigation and adaptation goals of the developing nations. So as you say, the difference between success and real success can be defined. Here I think we'll be measuring Paris in dollars.
I'm going to agree with Kevin on that. That's the one thing that Congress has enormous control over is appropriations into any sort of global climate fund for adaptation and clean energy deployment. And this
to implement this rule.
Right.
We're going to need new employees to implement these systems.
Right. And we all see I think that the Volkswagen scandal can help the EPA greatly because we've got a fantastic villain now that proves how much we as a society need well-funded regulators.
Gene, what do you think you'll be reporting on in January? What do you think the themes will be?
To the point of what you were just saying about the money, though, I would have to bring it up, but there was just a report the other day that we're already two-thirds of the way to the $100 billion for the commitment. The commitment is $100 billion from the developed world, including private donors, by 2020 and every year after, and we're already to two-thirds of that, so us collectively, the developed world. So the little $3 billion that the United States government, have pledged is actually a fairly small sliver of that, which I just think is interesting. But sorry, what are my stories
after
that?
What do you think?
I'm going to Paris, which will be interesting. And then after that, the selling of the deal to the American people, Obama saying this is the last piece of my, or a major last piece of my climate legacy, and anything that he does around that, James Inhofe trying to, scuttle it in various ways, all of those things are probably going to be.
And so Toby, well, thank you so much, Gene. Toby, will you be schizophrenic in January in that you'll be working with some states that want to work with the administration and then working with other states who don't? I mean, will that be your life in 2016, or will something else be happening next year?
I would anticipate Bird Hagel 2, but it will be Hagel somebody else. I think North Carolina has a good case if that's the way that they pursue it. I've always said, you should, if Congress really wanted to do something and they talk about congressional stays and things like that, why not have a congressional stay and mandate the EPA to seek a declaratory judgment that what they're doing is legal? Because you've seen it in MATS that, basically you have companies that do all these things and then it gets remanded back to, the courts and the EPA, and you don't necessarily have to do anything now because guess what? We've got all these things. We're not going to open up, go back to the controls, the non-controls that we had and things like that. We've already pumped enough money in there. So you've already done it without actually having to regulate it now. So I think that if you wanted to do that, you make them seek the declaratory judgment. You put it in their hands. You don't have industry and others, or the perception that we're dragging our heels and trying to delay this, because in all honesty, the court's going to go, you got until 2022 to even start. But at the end of the day, yes, we're going to be schizophrenic, and I would hope that states would look at it and say, I would much rather have the implementation plan in my, under my parameters as opposed to what the federal government wants me to do. So while I think that North Carolina and other states, and I'm not just saying, and again, I hope, we talked about it earlier, and the whole thing about North Carolina pursuing this is out, and I know South Carolina joined litigation along with West Virginia and everybody else. So, as they move forward, we're going to continue to work with them and try to figure out the best way forward and to provide the low-cost energy that our customers want. So.
Well, and this is Bill Snape, the moderator, stepping out of his role. My prediction in January is that the news on Exxon having suppressed climate science within their own corporation actually will be more something talked about. I think it will surpass VW when the facts all come out. And I think in 2016, throughout all the year, that the Republicans will feel themselves increasingly isolated to oppose a president who has put together a climate proposal that's actually pretty all-American. That's my prediction. But we'll be meeting in the cold air to talk about hot air in a few months. We look forward to it. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.